Welcome to the second of three in-depth interviews in our series titled How to Talk to Atheists. I'm Patrick Coffin. Jennifer Fulweiler's story of being raised in an atheist home and eventually discovering the beauty and truth of the Catholic faith is having an impact on a generation saturated in relativism and secularism. Jennifer is a contributor to the books The Church and the New Media and Atheist to Catholic, 11 Stories of Conversion, and she's the creator of the highly successful blog conversiondiary.com. Jennifer and her husband live in Austin, Texas with their six young children, and she's featured in the reality TV show Minor Revisions. In this interview, she addresses the personal side of the atheist equation, offering prudent and practical advice for speaking with loved ones who identify as atheists. Jennifer Fulweiler joins us now from Austin, Texas. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Finally get to talk to you in depth about your amazing story and distill from your own journey some nuggets of wisdom for perhaps families who have atheist kids or friends or coworkers who are looking for some Solomonic wisdom with how to talk to them in a way that's effective and powerful. So let's start. Speaking of powerful, I thought we'd begin with a note of humility. You are the most popular female blogger alive ever. True?
In the universe, I think, is the correct title.
I'm my tongue is only half in cheek here. You blogged your way through this conversion, didn't you?
I did. My blog, the one that I have today, actually, if you go way, way back in the archives and read the first post in 2005, I basically said, hey, guys, I'm kind of sort of still an atheist. I was always an atheist. And looking for answers, so let me know if anyone has any. So if you have about 30 hours to spare, you can actually read through mm-hmm. the entire process.
Well, with someone with no life, it's easy to me. I'll do that. Thanks to the Wayback
Machine.
We're always
in front of our computers, right?
Well, yeah, because we connect with real people, and that's the point.
Right.
Now, you started off as a happy atheist household. That was your family upbringing. Maybe take it from there. Were your parents doctrinaire atheists, or were they themselves raised in secular homes?
Well, my dad was really the atheist. He was raised in kind of a nominally Christian household. I think that his parents did believe, but, you know, they were kind of like, well, we're good people. We read the Bible every now and then, so no real need to go to church. The other thing is they lived in Mexico and South America for almost all of his childhood, so they just didn't have churches available to them always because they were Protestant. And so he just wasn't raised in a church-going household. And he really thought about it and asked questions and did a lot of research. He went to military school where he was required to take, you know, Bible classes, and he heard things that didn't make sense to him, and he kind of researched his way into atheism. And my mom is what philosophers call a Macyist. That is somebody who is far more concerned with whether Macy's has an additional 30% off this weekend than whether there's a compelling case for a monotheistic God.
I think that's an offshoot from Bloomingdale's-ism.
Exactly, yes. Right. That's a subset of that. Mm-hmm. So, important philosophical term to note. She was actually raised Catholic, and that's not something that was really that I was aware of in my childhood. To give you an example of how unaware of it was, I was, when I was in high school, I asked a question and somebody gave me the rhetorical answer, is the Pope Catholic? And I finally had to take someone aside and say, is the Pope Catholic? I don't know if this is a rhetorical yes or no.
Right.
So that is how far away I was from the religion of her youth. But mm-hmm. I think she had maybe a healthy sense of Catholic guilt of like, it's better just to not talk about this at all. I think she'd gone to Catholic school. Maybe she felt a little guilty that was not being passed on. And so she and I just never really talked about religion. And so it was my dad who we really bonded on that topic. And he did not raise me to be an atheist so much as he raised me to seek truth and ask tough questions mm-hmm. and question assumptions. And for me, that led me to atheism. But he didn't exactly indoctrinate me like, you must be an atheist. He just said, you know, here are the conclusions that I've come to. Make your own conclusion.
Jennifer, am I wrong in concluding that when parents say they don't want to force beliefs on their kids, that the kids should make up their own adult minds later down the road, that this is actually a recipe for atheism or agnosticism because kids naturally model their parents' behavior more than they do their words? Does that make sense?
I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think you're exactly right, and that's why I always kind of grimace when I hear well-meaning people say, like, well, I'm spiritual, but I'm raising my kids to be open-minded about religion. I think what doesn't occur to them is that they are effectively telling their children that objective truth does not exist. You know, because if you think that objective truth exists, then presumably you would tell that to your children. And so I think you're absolutely right that the subtle message is there that you're sending your kids is, I don't believe that objective truth exists, or if I do think it exists, I don't think it's really worth, you know, finding and looking for and following. So I think people need to really carefully think through those kind of messages.
As you're talking, Jennifer, I'm thinking of a quote from C.S. Lewis. I think it's from Surprised by Joy. I could be wrong, but he says this or similar words, I knew that God didn't exist, and I was angry with him for not existing.
I love that quote.
Which leads me to my next question about the atheist mind. Now, it's kind of getting inside the worldview or seeing the world through their atheist lenses. In your case, you simply were not really exposed to people who were Christians living their faith in a rational and joy-filled way. Is that half the problem, that atheists are in kind of an atheism echo box online and they go to Richard Dawkins' website or this or that forum and they don't interact with folks in the real world who are normal and credible and they believe that Jesus is the Son of God?
Absolutely. I think especially, as you say, in the internet age, it's a huge problem because you can just unfriend anyone who doesn't share your beliefs. You can, you know, get your RSS reader all set up so that you're only reading blogs that agree with you. And yeah, I think that's a real problem in the online age. Now, for me, I spent a lot of my childhood, we moved around a lot, but we spent a lot of time in the Bible Belt, in the suburbs of Dallas in the 1980s. And so I was surrounded by Protestantism, and it was a very vocal Protestantism. But the problem was, this was not the religion of the cross. This was about as far from it as you could get. And, you know, unfortunately, I did have some very negative encounters with Christians. And, you know, I had some positive ones, too. I don't want to paint them all, you know, with a bad brush. But there were plenty of occasions where, you know, I was a sensitive little kid. I was kind of a nerd in elementary school, and I would be rejected by my peers because my family didn't go to church. They'd say I was going to hell. They'd call me a Satan worshiper, and I was very much rejected on a social level for the fact that my family, we were, you know, we didn't publicly label ourselves atheists, but everybody knew we did not go to church, and we didn't own a Bible or, you know, anything like that. And I was very hurt by that. And then I would, you know, I'd see these people turning around. They drove really fancy cars, and it was a very statusy environment, especially in the late 80s in the Dallas area. And so I just didn't see these people, like, I didn't see Christ in them at all. I wouldn't have at the time known to look for that. But it's like I saw these people who were judging me, and yet, you know, they would turn around and drive their Cadillacs around, you know, to their, like, huge mansions and tell me that, you know, I was a sinner, and they would cheat on tests, you know, to get into the good schools and stuff like that. So that was really all I needed to just confirm my own worldview that we atheists, we took the moral high road, and these Christians were just a bunch of hypocrites who used their belief system to just judge other people and wield power over others. That by the time I got to college, that impression was very much solidified for me.
And then it came to a head at Christian summer camp when you were kind of pushed into a corner about whether or not you accepted Jesus Christ as your personal savior. Did that kind of seal the deal for you internally as an atheist?
Yes, and that actually happened earlier on. What happened was, you know, all of my friends were Christian. There was no, you know, there was no option of having other atheist friends. And, you know, my parents generously realized that if I was ever going to have friends, they couldn't completely shelter me from, you know, Christianity. So the only summer camps anyone went to were religious camps. And I believe I was in either fourth or fifth grade, somewhere around that time. And I got cornered by this camp counselor who, in front of everyone, said, you know, will you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? And I was afraid I would get in trouble with my parents if I said yes. I didn't even know who Jesus Christ was. I was very confused. And so I just didn't, I kind of, in so many words, said no after kind of, you know, being wishy-washy about it. And I just said, I can't answer that. And, you know, she told me that I was going to hell in front of the whole, you know, cabin of girls, and then nobody would speak to me. And that was a real turning point for me, because that was the moment when I said, I am an atheist. You know, before that, I had, as a child, you don't typically label yourself. You're just not developed enough to really think that way. But that was the moment that I really took that on and owned it and said, I'm an atheist, and I'm proud to be an atheist.
Right. You then went to the creek with your father, and this is, I think, an important turning point about the first remote idea of your own mortality came from looking at long ago frozen tokens of life that's been, you know, gone for millions of years. Tell us about that visit to the creek. What happened to you then?
Yeah, my family and I had a creek that was near my grandfather's house in this area that I live in now in Central Texas. And we were big, you know, armchair paleontologists. We loved to go down there. The place is full of fossils. This part of Texas used to be a shallow ocean. And so there are tons and tons of fossils down there. And this is also an area where my ancestors had lived since the 1850s. So I was surrounded by this history, you know, knowing my great-great-grandmother had walked this same land, and then, you know, these creatures used to be swimming around, and now they were all, you know, in stone. And it led me to this powerful moment of realizing how fleeting my own life was. Here I'm surrounded, I used to think of it in a comforting way, that I was surrounded by life that once was, but I had this moment when I was still relatively young at this time, when I realized that I was surrounded by death. You know, all of my ancestors, they're gone. And, you know, these fossils from so long ago, they were once alive just like I am. And now look at them. And that was the first time that not only my own mortality, you know, I think that we all have that moment of realizing our own mortality, but more importantly, my own mortality within the atheist worldview really hit me. And I didn't think of it as contrasted to any other point of view. It wasn't like, wow, this sure is depressing compared to the Christian view of heaven, because I had never once believed in God. I'd never once believed in an afterlife or souls or spirits or anything. So I just accepted it as the truth, like pondering the sky being blue. You know, it's not like there's an alternative explanation. And when it sunk in, it was so profoundly, you know, depressing is not even the word. It was like suddenly my life was just shattered of its meaning. And I just couldn't figure out why I should take the next step forward. Why should I go on? I mean, you know, a number multiplied by zero still yields zero, you know, no matter what that number is. And effectively, what I understood is death multiplies our lives by zero. And so I realized, It doesn't even matter if I die today, if I die 80 years from now, it doesn't matter. None of this matters. And so it was a real profound existential crisis.
And then you visited Graveyard of Ancestors and you looked at gravestones where multiple kids died quickly. And so infant child mortality, in a way, is closer to home because there weren't fossils from a million years ago. These are living, breathing people that you could have met and spoke to and laughed with, and now they're gone too. Take it from there.
Yeah, so that's, now we're jumping ahead to after I'd become a mother. And, you know, when I had my son, my first child, it was incredible for me. I grew up in, really, it was very much a culture of death environment where I don't think I ever had a single friend whose mother had a baby while I knew them. I mean, babies weren't ever part of my life growing up. And my husband had never held a baby until we had ours. Mm-hmm. So I was very much impacted by becoming a mother, and obviously I realized how valuable and precious my son is. And then I realized if I had lived in any other time in human history, and really in many other places in the world today, it would just be commonplace for this baby to die. I mean, it would just, you know, we'd be sad, but it would be, frankly, kind of a routine event. And I realized this as I was walking through my ancestral graveyard. I'd seen all these names all my life, you know, like H.W. Ware or whatever. And I always pictured them to be these blue-haired elderly people. Mm-hmm. And one day when my son was about a year old, I started looking at the dates. And I realized it was practically a children's graveyard before about 1910. And that also just made me really question at a level that, you know, it's one thing when your own mortality hits you, but when your children's mortality hits you, that really sent me into a crisis of asking, what is this all about and what is the purpose of life?
Do you think all this death was really a juicy seed that God was planting in your life for your benefit?
Absolutely, because What it did was it formed within me a great disconnect between what I quote-unquote knew intellectually and what I knew in my heart. Because, you know, as an atheist, I was always very distrustful of relying on, you know, feelings or emotions. And so I tried to squelch this, but it was undeniable that, you know, deep within me, there was this feeling that there's more to life than this. You know, that for example, if my son were to die, that it would not just be the cessation of some chemical reactions, which is what the atheist worldview told me, that, like, sure, we're just randomly evolved chemical reactions, and it's, you know, like killing an advanced gnat. I mean, it's not really any different. And something within me told me that's not true. It is not true that we're just, you know, that the only difference between us and a roach is that we're, you know, we're just more cognitively complex. It, something within me screamed that this is not true. And so I do think that God put those things in my path to sort of make me own up to the implications of the atheist belief system, which, you know, by the way, speaking of modern atheism, I think there is a real lack of owning up to the true implications of what human life is all about if the atheist materialist worldview is true. And so my dad had really raised me to be intellectually honest, to think through the conclusions of everything I believed. And when I did that, particularly as it came to death, it really set up that disconnect that made me start asking a lot of questions.
Atheists seem to like to take the moral and intellectual high ground as though only atheists ask the tough questions. Well, you use that protocol against the atheist worldview to resounding success.
Yes.
So you meet this Joe guy, so he's smart, although, you know, God bless him, a theist, and mercifully you learn that he would never take you near a Catholic church. How much did meeting your husband play in moving you toward a place within you where you can say yes to the gift of faith?
It was a big step because, you know, his story is that he was raised by a single mother, grew up very, very poor, and he went on to get degrees from Yale and Columbia and Stanford, and now he's a CPA and a lawyer. You know, there was no question that this guy was very, very smart. And yet, he not only was a theist, but even in some vague way considered himself a Christian. He didn't go to church or anything, but, you know, he would never deny Jesus. He told me that he had this powerful experience of the person of Jesus Christ when he was baptized when he was 13 in a full dunk baptism. Mm-hmm. And he said, I've known that Jesus is real ever since then. And I might not go to church, I might not read my Bible, but I'll never deny that. And it was shocking to me because the old line that I used to use to not have to deal with Christians was, they're unreasonable. These people just don't use reason. They're not that well educated. You know, it was a bunch of ignorant stereotypes that, yeah, I would use as a crutch. Mm-hmm. But with Joe, I couldn't do that. You know, I mean, graduates from Yale with honors in 3 years. I mean, you know, I couldn't use any of those old crutches. And so the turning point there was just that meeting him made me have to admit that reasonable people can be theists, which was actually, as stupid as it sounds, that was actually kind of a revelation to me. It made me let go of those stereotypes. I didn't necessarily think he was right. I didn't instantly believe in God, but I could no longer blow off all Christians as they're just not reasonable.
That took you from zero to one.
Right. So to speak. Yeah, exactly.
So then you and Joe run into blues legend Clifford Antone at a restaurant. And you guys are going to throw parties together. And this seems to be another signpost because for people who don't know who he is, you know, Texas mentor to Stevie Ray Vaughan and so on, and worldly success, public accolades end up representing a very thin kind of immortality, didn't it?
Yes, exactly. And that's actually after I had started, I'm not sure if I was even still fully an atheist at that point. I was more agnostic when we ran into Clifford Antone and started planning parties with him. And I do think it was maybe a temptation from the devil. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it definitely threatened to lure me off the path of conversion because it suddenly made me start asking questions like, why do I need to research Christianity? I can throw a party with Clifford Antone. You know, I've got all that I need right here. And, you know, all those old questions about death and the meaning of life, they don't seem so important when you have a bunch of sparkly distractions. And so that very much almost lured me off the path of conversion.
And you circled back with him to find out that he had actually died.
Right. And that was later. That was actually after our conversion. I had been meaning to get back in touch with him. And, you know, I was going to maybe see about doing a party at some point. Mm-hmm. And he had died rather suddenly. He was, I think, mm-hmm. only in his early 50s. And I hadn't heard the news. And it was really this profound moment that just confirmed everything for me. We were close to entering the church at that point. And it really hit home for me, you know, wow, I've taken the right path, because I saw myself in him, you know, that we know not the hour or the day. You never know when it's going to be all over. And it was a very profound confirmation mm-hmm. for me.
Jennifer, do you think there's a rising tide of atheism thanks in part to the internet? Or is it the same low percentage of village atheists who now have a much bigger audience thanks to the invention of the modem?
I do think there is a rising tide. I think that one of the reasons is that the new atheists have done really a breathtakingly excellent job mm-hmm. of branding atheism as being for the intelligentsia. And that is the big prize of our age, is to be smart. You know, in other eras, maybe the highest goal that a person could achieve would be, say, to be virtuous. But in our age, it is to be smart. And to be smart is to have value, it's to have worth. And so I do think that this is luring a lot more young people who are maybe lost. They just don't know what they believe. In another age, they may have just sort of labeled themselves agnostic, or, you know, maybe just they would say, I'm not a churchgoer, and leave it at that. But in this day and age, there's a payoff to labeling yourself an atheist and really embracing that. And it's that atheist is now a code word for smart. And I see a lot of people buying into this.
There's definitely an evangelical fervor nowadays. I was walking with my family recently in Balboa Park here in beautiful San Diego, and there was a guy with a little booth, and on the front of the booth was a sign that said, relax, there's probably no God. Just enjoy your life. And I'm walking by with kids everywhere, and I thought, this probably wouldn't have transpired even 20 years ago, where it's in your face with a almost like sticking their chin out, I dare you to sock me, because we'll get into it right here.
Yep.
You know, there's definitely a public acceptance of atheism as the view of views.
Well, and also you see a lot of intellectual dishonesty there, frankly. I think another issue that's going on is that people are not educated, you know, in classical education where they learn philosophy. And you actually see it in that poster right there that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There's probably no God, so enjoy your life. Philosophers of old would have said, okay, maybe there's probably no God. And if they came to that conclusion, they would not therefore say, oh, so go enjoy your life. You know, they at least had the intellectual rigor to say, wow, so this is seriously bad news if there's no God and no afterlife and all we are is a bunch of randomly evolved chemical reactions. But because people aren't trained how to think these days, I had a great conversation with a priest who actually has a background in nuclear engineering, and he was talking about how he sees this, that people are not trained how to think philosophically. We know how to think mathematically and scientifically, but not philosophically. And I think that that's another thing that's fueling this atheism, is you get to feel smart, you get to label yourself as smart, but these are really very thin and weak arguments that they're relying on.
Did you find that some books were more valuable than others when you were coming back, kind of groping your way to the place where you could at least open the door intellectually to something like a gift of faith? I know that you've mentioned Mere Christianity. What other books were eye-openers for you?
I think the biggest thing for me was that I had to find authors who could speak my language, so to speak. For example, when I was first on the path to discovering the gift of faith, I encountered a couple of authors who themselves had always been believers. Maybe they fell away to some extent or another, but they had never really understood the atheist mentality. And quite a few of those people, we were just missing each other. And interestingly, some of these people are very well known for converting Protestants. That, you know, I would meet a Protestant in our CIA who said, oh, me and, you know, five other people converted after reading this book. And I would try to read that book. And it just wasn't we were just totally missing each other. So I found that either former atheists or at least people who really, really understood the atheist mindsets were the ones who could really reach me. So C.S. Lewis, as you said, G.K. Chesterton, I don't think he was ever exactly an atheist, but he was certainly very far away from faith. And his analytical way of looking at things and breaking down arguments, his use of logic and reason really resonated with me. Some of the stuff by the Protestant guy, Lee Strobel, not all of it, but some of the stuff he wrote really hit home with me because I do believe he was truly an atheist, and so he could kind of reach me in a way that maybe other authors couldn't. And even, you know, some of the old classics like Aquinas, you know, I didn't read it in depth at that point. It was a little, Aquinas was a little heavy for someone who was still basically agnostic. But just to see his eminently rational thought patterns really grabbed me, because that's what I needed. I needed critical thinking. I needed, you know, logic, kind of an engineer's approach to this question of faith. And that's what really grabs me.
Jennifer, one thing I've noticed about atheists when they witness another atheist becoming a believer is, he was never really an atheist. Did you sort of see things that way? Yeah.
I hear that every day. I did used to think that. And I felt like I had some confirmation because sometimes I would hear, you know, in college, people would, you know, hand me something that was an essay supposedly written by a former atheist. And a lot of times there would be tells in their language that maybe I was wrong, but they seemed to tell me that this person was never an atheist. For example, they might say, oh, back in this time, during my godless years, I felt like something was missing, and I felt weighed down by the chains of sin. And I would think, well, wait a minute, first of all, no atheist that I've ever met really believes in sin exactly. I mean, it's kind of complicated, but there's right and there's wrong, but whatever I'm doing is typically fine because I'm a good person. And also, you know, no atheist that I knew ever consciously felt like something was missing. Looking back, I see that there was something missing, but I did not feel that way at the time. So anyway, a lot of times I did question atheist to theist conversions because of things like that. I would say, you know, you just don't sound like an atheist to me when you're describing your former self.
So turning a corner now, Jennifer, you entered RCIA. I wanted to ask you how your atheist family took the news that you were not only becoming Christian, but you were going to go whole hog into the Catholic Church.
Well, that's a great question. Very interesting story. My mom was, you know, again, we don't talk about religion. So she just said, that's great. I'm glad you guys have found something. But she was very supportive and, you know, perfectly nice about it. Now, I didn't know what my dad would think. Again, he was the big atheist. And he wrote me this very sweet note right before Easter Vigil. And he said, I want you to know that I'm really proud of you because, as you know, I always taught you to seek truth first and foremost. And it seems to me that that's what you have been doing. You know, you didn't make this decision based on emotion. And interestingly, he saw the sacrifices that Joe and I made, that we gave up a very lavish lifestyle directly related to our conversion. I had some medical issues. I had doctors telling me I had to use contraception and I wouldn't do it. And I think my dad was really impressed that we were at least following through the logical conclusions of our newfound belief system and not, you know, picking and choosing what we wanted to believe. And so it was really a great moment for both of us that he let me know that I absolutely had his support and respect, even though he didn't understand my conversion. And it really meant a lot to me that he had always said, I'm not telling you to be an atheist so much as I am telling you to seek truth. And I wondered if that was really going to stand when I told him I was entering the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it did. And to this day, he continues to be very supportive.
Well, that's a very dangerous stance for your father to take in light of
what... Right, I know. He better be careful. Right.
Because,
you never know what's going to happen.
Well, because if atheists are right, and God is more or less like Santa, but in heaven, not the North Pole, and there are angels instead of elves, then atheists who are really hardcore in their atheism must look at a Jennifer Fulweiler and think, the poor woman has lost it. How can she believe in a you know, Richard Dawkins flying spaghetti monster?
Yeah.
What about morality?
Well, usually the line they use is, she was never really an atheist, because then they don't have to deal with me and they don't have to ask any questions. They just have to say, she always believed in God, so we'll just, you know, move on to the next blog to troll.
I was going to ask you about morality. When you were an atheist, did you kind of cobble together a moral code that seemed to work and was practical? Or was that part of the reason why you became a believer, Jennifer, that you ran into the natural moral law, which was an objective thing that you couldn't get your arms around, therefore you knew it was bigger than you were? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, yes and yes. When I was younger, I had, like many atheists, cobbled together a moral code, one that I was very proud of. And I was a big fan of that line that, you know, why can't we just be good people without a book telling us what to do? Look, when I was an atheist, I volunteered to tutor disadvantaged students. And I was very proud of the atheist worldview in the sense that, you know, I saw Christians doing that too. And I would say, well, I'm better than them because they're doing it because some book tells them to do it. But I'm doing it, you know, out of the goodness of my heart. And that all worked for a while until I realized that we atheists had an ocean of unquestioned assumptions when it came to the issue of morality. For example, I'll never forget, I was riding the bus on my way to college classes one time, and I read a newspaper article about one of these atheist professors. You may know who it is. I forget which one it was at the time. Mm-hmm. But he made a statement that it would be more ethical to kill a newborn baby than a pig because an adult pig is more cognitively complex than a newborn baby. And after all, that is, and I would have agreed with this, that is how we atheists determined value. And I had even said this myself when someone would say, Jennifer, why are human beings more valuable than a worm from an atheist point of view? I would have said, well, we're more complex. We can reason, you know, we can experience this and that. And so when this professor said that, you know, a fellow atheist, I was appalled. I thought, what an offensive statement. But then I realized, I can't argue with this from a strict atheist materialist point of view.
Right.
And I'll never forget, I set that newspaper down, and it was this moment of having this moral code that I was so proud of being shattered and realizing, you know, maybe I choose to say, you know, like with my weekend, I'm going to go tutor disadvantaged children. But if you're basing your moral code, which I did, on sort of this evolutionary, you know, where human beings thrive when they live in harmonious communities, therefore we should choose the behaviors that, you know, lead to the most harmony. Suddenly I realized, well, actually, you could look at evolution and choose an entirely different moral code. For example, saying, let's kill off the weak, take all of their goods, and only the strongest and most fit people will thrive.
Right.
And I realized that no one can say which one is better than the other. That if a fellow atheist said, hey, I'm going to go kill weak people and take all their stuff because that's my moral code, I could not objectively say, no, 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 the serving the poor moral code is better than that moral code.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Eventually I kind of became disgusted with my fellow atheists that, like, can we not admit that we have a huge problem here in the area of morality?
So there's no real justification on the strict atheist worldview why helping disadvantaged children or students is superior to bashing their heads in.
There's not. And people, if you were to say this online, your blog would explode with like hundreds of comments of people saying that's a terrible thing to say and that's not fair. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it is fair, and that is absolutely true about atheist morality, that you cannot say that one is objectively better than the other. It's all personal preference.
Yeah, if we're just electric meat,
biochemical
result of billions and billions of Carl Sagan years. I want to ask you about the pro-life issue and your discovery of the jarring contradiction between, on the one hand, being able to save babies at early gestation, and on the other hand, having the legal right under Roe v. Wade to kill the same aged babies.
Yes. Yeah. Well, before that, I already had this contradiction in my mind that I had always been pro-choice, staunchly so, and I will never forget the first time I had an ultrasound with my son. It was at 20 weeks, so a little bit earlier than the age of viability. You know, because I would have definitely said I supported abortion, you know, before the age of viability, and 20 weeks counts there. But interestingly, you know, the pro-choice movement is not big on information, not really big on details. And so, you know, I had donated money to NOW. I'd been really involved with these people. And then I see this ultrasound at 20 weeks, and I mean, it was a baby, not some, you know, like amorphous fetus. I mean, this was a baby. There was a distinct profile that I would eventually recognize, this exact profile when he was born. Mm-hmm. He was kicking, he was touching his face, he was moving around. It literally took my breath away. And although I was still pro-choice, I felt an anger at the pro-choice movement of, why didn't anyone tell me? I didn't know that babies look like this at this age. I mean, that's, my own eyes are telling me this is a baby. And then there was another issue with my second child. My second child was a girl, and I had an ultrasound a little earlier, maybe 18 weeks. Again, it was like, wow, that's a baby. No kidding, a real baby. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, because I still considered myself pro-choice, I had to support female gender-selective abortion, because if it's true that it's all just a woman's right and, you know, these quote-unquote fetuses aren't fully human, then if a woman says, huh, I see that it's a girl on the ultrasound, I don't want a girl, so let's go ahead and terminate this pregnancy, I had to support that, even as a so-called feminist. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first, I still considered myself pro-choice, as crazy as that sounds, but that was the first moment in which I saw Something's really messed up here.
I know there's no formula or template because everyone's different, Jennifer, but are there any basic rules to abide by when talking to atheists? I think there's some Catholics who tend to assume that atheism is a result of illogic, and so the answer is to pour on logic. What's wrong with that approach?
Well, I think there is a lot that is right about it. But I will say, in my experience, and at this point, I think I've literally heard hundreds of atheist to Catholic conversion stories from just people emailing me. The problem is, you know, you've mentioned a lot in this interview, like talking about the workings of grace and the gift of faith. And mm-hmm. I think for those of us who have maybe a little bit more analytical bend and, you know, we kind of tend to live in our heads, it's so, so tempting, especially in this society, to fall into this idea that faith is nothing more than intellect. That, you know, if I can just make the right arguments to these atheists, then they'll see, oh, what do you know? Atheism is illogical. Where's the nearest RCIA class?
Right.
And it really seems like it should work that way, right? You call up Richard Dawkins and you say, you know, have you really, you know, asked these questions? And he says, oh my gosh, Patrick, I hadn't. Well, I'm going to become Catholic now.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. Now, that is not to say that these intellectual arguments aren't important. They're actually very important. But we have got to remember that our witness and, most importantly, our prayers are what's really going to change hearts and minds and really lead to conversions, because we can never forget that it is the Holy Spirit and not our brilliant arguments that make atheists convert.
How much of a role do you think a sinful lifestyle plays in the lives of many modern atheists? I'm not saying that all atheists are sinners and all Catholics are saints, but the Catechism is very clear that sin darkens your intellect and weakens your will. In other words, it makes you stupid. How much do you think that atheists today know that they would have some serious and uncomfortable choices to make if they were ever to move toward Christianity and to justify a lifestyle that's quite outside the natural moral law? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I think that is a huge, huge, huge issue, especially as we just devolve deeper and deeper into confusion on the area of human sexuality. I mean, look at what our culture accepts as just a normal part of life these days. I mean, pornography and, you know, all sorts of crazy behavior in that department. And for a lot of people, this is just part and parcel of their lives. And so I think that they don't even get that far to say, oh, Christianity is compelling, but gosh, it would be hard to give up all these things if I were to become Christian. Mm-hmm. There is such a block that as soon as they hear that there's a police system that says, you know, these things that you're doing all the time are gravely wrong and you would have to stop doing them if you converted, I think they just reject any belief system out of hand that says that. So it's like you can't even get to the point of planting the seed. I think it's a really big issue.
So it's as much or more a spiritual dynamic than an intellectual one. Because you can line up all the proofs of Thomas Aquinas and Pascal's wager and layer on all the traditional proofs, and they might conclude, well, meh, but I don't want to change this behavior because it's become part of my personality.
Exactly. No one is ever going to hear a truth unless they are open to hearing it. But, you know, one thing I always say, a lot of people, they hear all this and they say, well, I'm depressed. You know, sounds like there's no hope for my atheist son if he's mired in sin and isn't going to hear the truths if he's not open to hearing them. But one little nugget that I always tell people that I think they find encouraging is that, you know, having spent years in atheist culture, both as a child being surrounded by adult atheists and then in early adulthood, for me, one thing to know about atheist culture, you know, if you have a loved one who is, you know, surrounding themselves with atheists, is very often they tend to be nice people. You know, they're perfectly great. I'm not saying they're bad people or anything, but there is a cynicism and a darkness, this undercurrent that runs through those social circles. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen an exception to it. In every single, you know, atheist social circle I've ever been a part of, ever witnessed, ever seen, there's this, I guess you could say it's a lack of real love, which is not to say that they're not trying to love. They are in their own way. But, you know, without Christ, you don't know what real love is. And so if you have an atheist loved one who is hanging out in these social circles, if you bathe them in the light of Christ and the love of Christ, it might not happen instantaneously, but I guarantee you, I promise you, there will be some night when that person is lying awake at night, you know, sick of hearing the 50th sarcastic comment from, you know, their group of friends that day, and they think, you know, my Catholic mother or sister or friend, like, every time I'm around her, I feel this warmth, I feel this peace, I feel this something that I don't find anywhere else. And I promise you that will happen, you know, if we continue to be persistent and show our atheist loved ones, show them Christ as much as we talk to them about Christ.
Do you find, Jennifer, that some of the traditional arguments for God's existence can make a dent in an atheist if you've created that open door?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I always say I don't mean to discount those intellectual arguments at all, because I do think, especially in this modern world that prizes intellectual arguments so much, it would be hard to imagine a lot of intellectual type atheists converting without them. So yes, the seed needs to be planted, the door needs to be open, but once that door is open, we have an incredible arsenal at our disposal that we can arm ourselves with, you know, 2,000 years of the great Catholic body of wisdom and intellectual tradition. And I think, again, once the heart is open, the mind can really start to absorb these truths, and that's when you really see things pick up.
How do you respond to the standard and according to Thomas Aquinas, the most formidable objection to God's existence is the suffering of innocence? People listening right now who have children, people who know the horror of a life-threatening diagnosis in a child or anything in which the normal rules seem to be broken by God himself by allowing innocence to suffer terribly.
That is such a tough one. And for me, actually, that was a real linchpin in my conversion, and it actually led me closer to God to ponder that issue, because I thought, you know, from the atheist perspective, all the human race has ever known is misery and suffering. I mean, you know, we all live these pampered lives compared to, you know, my ancestors in the cemetery that we were talking about. You know, a lot of them, colon cancer runs in my family. A lot of them died of colon cancer, you know, before there was any kind of modern medicine. I mean, it was misery. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is the human experience. Why on earth do we think it's so wrong? You know, it occurred to me that there was something outside the material world there telling us that this is such a horror. Because from a pure atheist materialist point of view, it's like, yeah, of course kids get cancer and die. Cancer is a biological fact. It's something that's always been there. And, you know, we should just have this attitude of it is what it is. but we don't. And why don't we? And that's what made me realize that we're programmed for another place. You know, as Chesterton and Lewis are always talking about, this isn't our homeland. And once I heard that, I thought, you know, that really feels right, that in our hearts, we know of another way. We know of another kind of existence. And that is what, it's because we know that, that we're so filled with the horror of suffering. And then, frankly, just looking at the crucifix kind of answered it for me, that, you know, I guess I'd always pictured when I was first considering theism, God being, you know, like you said, the white-bearded man on the cloud, kind of like Santa. Mm-hmm. But to look at the crucifix and realize that's God. That's God, the creator of the universe, the creator of us all, suffering, you know, phlegm dripping from his face, dying. And I realized God does not ignore human suffering. He suffers with us. He jumped down into this mess that, frankly, we mostly created and suffered with us. And so the issue of suffering was really one of the things that very much brought me to faith.
You mentioned crucifix. The crucifix, to me, is one of the unique Catholic distinctives. Catholics do not typically employ bare crosses, but rather crucifix. So let me ask you this. Why Catholic and not Protestant? Why crucifix and not empty cross?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people went atheist, Protestant, Catholic. Mm. Because I instantly saw the need for authority, I went straight atheist to Catholic. But that's an issue of, you know, sola scriptura and biblical authority. But in terms of the cross, you know, one compelling thing is when I was first converting, first exploring Christianity, my husband and I went with my mother-in-law to one of these big Texas mega churches where, you know, big famous preacher, you know, having everyone laughing and crying. And as I looked around, I realized there was something missing. And interestingly, this is also when I was most struggling about suffering. I was pregnant with my second child, thinking about, you know, children dying. I looked around this mega church, and there were no crosses or crucifixes or anything. And I realized that I saw sort of a progression. Like, once you take the corpus off of the crucifix, then you just have a bare cross. And then, you know, if that's too much of a reminder of the grim parts of human life, just take the crosses out. You know, they had little pictures of doves and pictures of globes, but there was no cross at all. And that was a real turning point for me, that I realized all these questions I had about suffering could only be answered with the crucifix. And it's only the Catholics who actually use the crucifix. That was a very compelling moment for me.
Do you think that bringing up the crucifix as a strategy or something to plant seeds can very easily backfire if you do it too quickly? I mean, if someone doesn't even believe that the universe had a transcendent cause for its existence, is it getting a little bit ahead of ourselves to bring up something so profound and so personal as Jesus' death on the cross to someone who's, you know, not anywhere near that? In other words, how important is it to start with the multiplication table before you dive into calculus?
Absolutely. You know, there are, I guess, exceptions for different people, but I would say as a general rule, yeah, you really can get ahead of yourself with that, because our entire American culture is ordered towards not thinking about the concept of suffering. I mean, you know, open any magazine, watch any TV commercial, TV show, and you see it's this, you know, like what I used to be seeking with Clifford Antone. Like, let's just pretend that the world is all fun and parties and nobody ever suffers and we have control over everything. And so when you hit someone with, bang, crucified God, it's just, you know, first they have to start thinking about the idea of suffering. Then they have to think about redemptive suffering, which is a whole, you know, strange mindset to someone. Mm-hmm. You know, in our culture, suffering is the greatest evil. And so this idea of redemptive suffering is like, what? It's mind-blowing to people. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the crucifix is a lot to absorb, mm-hmm. and you do kind of need to ease into that.
How often do you interact with atheists now? Do they kind of go around you like a moth going around an interesting candle, or do you get flamed and despised a lot?
I get flamed and despised a lot when I write about atheism. In fact, if you Google me currently, the fifth result for my name, if you Google my name, says Jennifer Fulweiler, vacant, vapid-eyed, mindless cluelessness personified. that was from our friend P.Z. Myers. He's a big fan of mine in a certain way, as you can tell.
Yes.
And so when I write about atheism, inevitably I'll have maybe 200 hateful comments and about a similar number of emails. When I just write about Catholic stuff, you know, occasionally I'll get this stray troll saying, like, well, it's stupid that you believe in God anyway. But for the most part, if I am not talking about atheism, they just kind of ignore me.
Wow. I'm actually jealous of that appellation from P.Z. Myers. That's a thing of beauty right there.
He has a tag on his blog for my name. He really has a special place in his heart for me.
Jennifer, do you think that when people become public atheists, almost like an incorporation, that they not only have a worldview to leave, but they have an empire that they've created to leave? I'm thinking of the high-profile guys, you know, Sam Harris or Daniel Dennett or, rest his soul, Chris Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, that they have a whole community of fans and a fan base that they know what'll happen if they leave their atheist party, that they'll get flamed and slagged and insulted as you have. How much of that is at play, do you think, when people commit themselves to the public identity marker of atheism? The stakes are much higher for them.
Oh, yeah, and it's one of the dangers of the online world. I mean, aren't we all public figures in a certain way, you know, thanks mm-hmm. to Facebook? So even if you just have it all over Facebook, I'm an atheist, I'm part of the atheist club, you know, you have the little red A, you know, then, it, you know, your ego starts to get involved. And conversion would be very painful because it would be a big blow to your ego and to your social circles. It reminds me of, on my blog one time, I wrote some tips for seekers who were, you know, trying to convert. It had to do with things like work on humility and, you know, read the great Christian authors for people who that seed had been planted, but they didn't know what to do from there. And I got this brilliant email from a young man, one of the favorite emails I've ever received. He said, I like your post. I think you have a lot of great steps for what to do next if you're seeking. But he said, you missed one. He said, I think the first thing that any seeker has to do is to be willing to lose it all. Because if there's anything you're holding back, whether it's your pride, your ego, your house, your job, your status, it's probably going to block you from finding God. And he said, first, you have to be willing to lose it all. And I think, you know, you really see that with these online atheists, like you're talking about, that they would have to get to a point of being willing to lose it all, literally, before they could ever consider God, because they have so much worldly stuff wrapped up in their atheist identity.
And isn't that, in your smaller way, the thing that most impressed your father?
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting. Huh. Yeah, I'd never put that together, but I think you're exactly right.
For people, and this is my final question, you mentioned the importance of living your life in a way that signals credibility and trustworthiness, and you certainly saw that in Joe, even before he was Mr. Fulweiler. But speak to the person listening right now who's teenage girl or boy has finally announced, well, I'm an atheist. The initial reaction can be kind of a heart-pangy panic. What advice do you give to people on that very important question of personal witness in the way you talk to a loved one?
I almost hate to say this because it sounds so stereotypical, but it is so true. You have to show them Christ as much as you talk to them about Christ. And I think one of the key things is see what is good in them. That is one thing that we have on our side, is that the world is so harsh to people. The world is constantly telling our sons and daughters, you're not pretty enough, you're not thin enough, you don't have enough money. The world is constantly beating us down. And I think that having the love of Christ is a really powerful thing to lead to conversions. You know, telling that atheist daughter, like, you know, wow, you're so beautiful. I hope you know, what a beautiful girl you are. Or, you know, telling our son, like, you're so intelligent. I'm really impressed with how you're doing in your schoolwork. And having someone who can not get frustrated with them, because let's face it, that's frustrating. You know, when your kids mm-hmm. make these choices that you're like, what? It's so tempting to start to focus on, like, you know, well, maybe if you didn't hang out with those friends, then you wouldn't be an atheist. But instead to bathe them in this love of Christ that sees their goodness where the world doesn't, I really think that there's almost nothing more powerful that we could do.
Jennifer Fulweiler, I want to thank you so much for helping us improve the way we talk to atheists. And thanks above all for being a gift and for saying yes.
Thank you, Patrick. Keep up the great work.
This has been the second of three interviews in our series, How to Talk to Atheists, produced by Catholic Answers. For more information, visit our website, catholic.com.